Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
Hello, Kelly. Don't you love this weather?
It's so funny. You Californians, every time, I swear to God, my dad said the same thing. I was talking to him on the iPhone, like FaceTime, and he's like, oh, it looks like a nice day. I'm like, Dad, it's a effing nice day every day.
Oh, but this is special. It's 68 degrees,
I know,
70 degrees,
nice.
Southern
yeah.
California in it's, September.
You know, it's so funny. I literally brought a sweater. Like, this is sick. Sickness going on.
And this is bikini weather for me.
Yeah, exactly.
it's perfect.
It is really funny.
We
I brought
have
a sweater.
Clouds. Oh my gosh, it's amazing. So, how are you? I think you get the stress medal this week.
Holy smokes. My God. Well, here's the good news. I do want to report, and I want all our listeners to know, my younger son is officially, drumroll please, potty trained.
Potty trained officially.
Praise
no more accidents.
The Lord. No more accidents. The poop is actually going in the toilet. Like, this is huge. Like, I'm not kidding you. Like, people think I was, like, joking when I was like, he's going to be 27. But thank God. It is official. I was going to burn the potties, but I decided to sell them, and somebody bought them. So it's done. Like, it's a done deal. Like, he's using the real toilet.
That's awesome. But, you know, you're going to owe that kid a lot of money in the future.
Right.
For every time you talk about this on air. And every listener that we have, which is upwards of over 300,000
Yeah,
now,
exactly. Right.
Will be, he'll want a dime for every
time.
Yes.
Exactly. My God. That is, he might go to therapy, though. I don't know. He might need it. So, oh, yeah, yeah. So that's the good news. And then the other piece of great news is I'm going away this weekend. Like, I said to my husband, I don't care if we need to, like, scrub toilets in a Mexican prison. If we're away from our kids, I'm happy. So that's the deal. Very exciting.
Very exciting. Did you lock in on a location?
No. This place that I really want to stay at has a minimum. So I'm, like, begging the guy. I'm like, you don't understand. I'm a parent who needs to get away from my kids. He probably thought I was nuts. But so we'll see. I think it'll be okay. I think it'll work out.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I'm so excited for you. Yeah.
You too. What happened with you this week?
Me this week was a lesson for me in expectations and boundaries, actually. You know, I told you about the family trip that I had the week before, and I realized that I had a number of disappointments, which is okay. You know,
sure.
Because I realized, though, that nobody did anything wrong, and I love my family, and they're amazing, and everybody was just being who they are.
Yeah.
But I realized that I had expectations, and as I always say, expectations are resentment. Under construction. So it took me a week of processing, and I wrote my nieces and my daughter letters, and just to sort of, you know, let that go and apologize for my being rude, because I was rude, because I was expecting something that wasn't really what everybody else had agreed to. So I know we preach this stuff a lot, but it's always fun and fascinating and very encouraging for the growth process when we can really see it in our own lives and say, Yep. It really works when you do the boundaries and you understand expectations. So
good for you.
It was
you.
A beautiful lesson for me. It was a hard one.
Yes.
Lots of tears, but, you know, I'm standing. I'm still standing.
It's so much easier to dole out the advice than to do it ourselves.
Isn't it?
It's insane.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, good for you.
No, yeah. So other than that, I just have a, you know, just a peaceful weekend coming up. Christopher's daughter's coming up to see us, so maybe go do a little wine tasting or some other fun things, you know, because, you know, where we live, it's like, that's your backyard.
Yes,
you know,
exactly. So nice. Good.
Okay, well, let's see. If you'd like to give us a call, 323-203-0815. Again, 323-203-0815. I had a zzz in there.
I heard. It's because you're tired. Or at
we
least
want
I am.
To thank our sponsor so much, Vantage Recovery Point. We're going to hear a word from our sponsor.
Are you getting tired of trying to create a positive life with a negative mind? Vantage Point Recovery believes that the potential wholeness and well-being of our clients depends on a systematic approach to developing an authentic and fulfilling life. Specializing in the treatment of individuals struggling with mental health and substance use disorders, we believe that your journey is our journey. Call us today at 888-668-5959. To see how our program may be able to create a shift in the thinking of you or a loved one.
Thank you, Vantage. And, you know, before we launch into our very exciting guest today, we just say a word of thanks to our guest, Kevin McKenna, from last week, who talked to us about homelessness in America. And I did find myself all week long, whenever I saw somebody on the side of the road, I either offered them some sort of food or I gave them, you know, a dollar or whatever I had on me at the time. And it made me feel good.
It was such an inspiring, you know, show in the sense that, yeah, it was super informative. It was just gave me a different perspective. It was a really good show. He was a great guest.
It was very healing, actually, to think about how sometimes we can be really prejudiced about people that are not doing anything wrong.
Exactly.
You know, just, it's life circumstances. So good lessons there.
Yeah.
So I will let you do the honors.
Yay.
This is a woman who you met recently.
Yes. So I'm super, super excited this week to bring to all of you listeners Karen Muller, who is a war journalist. And it's a really, really wonderful story. I went to this wonderful organization called Best Day Ever, and they help special needs kids, teach them surfing, different things, and it's all volunteers. And I met this wonderful volunteer, Karen, and this is what she does in her off time. I mean, here's a woman who, you know, is a journalist and running around crazy, and, you know, basically in her spare moments, she volunteers to help kids in need, and I thought that was just so beautiful. So I'm going to read her bio. She's an author, filmmaker, and photographer. Karen Muller set out to document the world's historic highways. Her journeys have taken her to live with Japan's pre-Buddhist mountain ascetics and
easy
the Maasai. Yeah, exactly. Of East Africa, smuggle endangered animals out of Vietnam, dodge rebels and dust storms in Sudan, hitchhike through Cuba, and round up Vicunas in the Andes. I hope I'm saying all these right. Karen has written three highly acclaimed books on the Inca, Japan, and Vietnam, and produced international television series for PBS and National Geographic. Karen founded an international nonprofit organization that helps students use her footage to produce their own documentaries in the process of both educating the public and learning global citizenships. Welcome, Karen.
Welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Yay. Super, super.
Oh, my God. You've had such an exciting and interesting life. I can't even believe it when I hear this stuff, and it's like, it's profound. Maybe you could start with just what is the theme and the goal of your stories?
Well, you know, everything in my life has been about humanizing other people and cultures. And that's going to sound almost trivial, but I truly believe that the only way we're ever going to have peace in this world is if we start to see each other for who we really are, barbers and bricklayers, as opposed to these stereotypes, the monsters in our own imagination. And if you'll forgive me, I try and explain things with stories.
We love
because
stories.
That's really how my life works. So can I tell you a very short story about somebody that I met in the field?
Please.
Yes. And I have to say, most of my stories start with I did something really stupid. and then somewhere along the way, I get rescued by the locals. I was in Havana, Cuba, and I was filming this extraordinarily good local jazz band. It was so good that I actually stayed way too long. So it's 2 a.m. by the time I packed up my equipment, and I'm heading back across Havana to my little youth hostel with about $20,000 worth of camera gear around my neck on a very dark street. And Havana's quite safe, but that's really asking for it. And these two guys show up in sort of a classic pincer move, and you immediately know that you're in trouble. I have a couple black belts, but there's no way I'm fighting off two guys with that much camera gear. And so I start to move quickly, and I'm looking for a weapon, a very specific weapon. And in Havana, you should know that it's very hot, so everybody's got a balcony, and there's always people sitting out on the balconies, even at 2 a.m. And finally, I find what I'm looking for, which is a little granny. And she's sitting in the second floor on her balcony in her nightie. And I stop right under her, and I start talking to these guys in a louder voice. And they're getting quite aggressive. And after about 30 seconds, I look up, and I say in my best little girl's voice, Abuelita, ayúdame. Grandmother, help me, please.
Oh, wow.
And this woman kind of gets half out of her seat, looks over the side, and starts to scream at these two guys.
Wow.
The whole of Havana can hear her, basically.
Wow.
And they just, poof, you know, they evaporate.
Wow.
They disappear like a soap bubble in a high wind. And then she says to me, you, come up. And so I go up the inside stairs, and I sit down with her, and I find out instantly that she is blind. She has diabetes.
Oh.
She's 72 years old. Her name is Marta. And We have a bowl of rice and beans together. She was born in that apartment, and she's lived there for 72 years. And there is no secret within a six-block radius that Marta doesn't know.
Wow.
And for the rest of my three-month film shoot in Havana, I go back to see her basically every week. Every time in Havana, we have a bowl of rice and beans, and I say, Marta, I need a tobacco farmer. And if she doesn't know one, she knows the postman who knows one.
Wow.
I end up getting about half of my best stories that I filmed in Cuba from Marta.
This is so beautiful. Wow. Unbelievable. I love that.
That's amazing. You have a story about a Cuban refrigerator, too, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah, Cuba's this fabulous place because it's one of my favorite. The people are fun. They're incredibly friendly. They're genuine. They're warm. They're sexy. They help you in every way they can. They're unbelievably creative. And I think the Cuba is a great example of that. The refrigerator is a great example of that. There are a couple of things you need to know. There's a whole sign language in Cuba for words you don't want to say. If you sort of pretend to stroke a long beard, you're referring to Fidel Castro.
Oh, no.
If you tap yourself on the shoulder with two fingers, you're saying there's secret police around. If you touch the tip of your tongue, that means an informant.
Wow.
So you learn this language fairly quickly, especially if you have a big camera and you're filming undercover.
Yeah.
At one point, I was in Havana on the street, and a local walked by and tapped himself on the shoulder, and I immediately knew that there was a Secret Service guy coming, or secret police. And so I tucked the camera under my arm, and I bolted through the nearest door. Havana being stinking hot, every door is open. I'm going down this long hallway. The first person I see is a woman. I say in Spanish, please hide me.
Mm.
The other thing you need to know about Cuba is about 20 years ago, Castro gave every single family a huge blue Russian refrigerator, and they all immediately broke. And the Cubans have this awesome black sense of humor, so they call them coconuts because they're hard on the outside and empty on the inside. And they're all still in everybody's refrigerator. So without blinking an eye, this woman opens up her refrigerator. I climb inside. She closes it after me. And I listen to a muffled conversation she has with the guy who chased me in. Eventually, she opens the door, and we have a bowl of rice and beans, and I give her $5 Cuban, which is basically $6-7 U.S., but it's about a week's wages.
Yeah.
And she shows me a way out the back. And this turns out to be such a good idea that I just start carrying $5 in my pocket everywhere I go. And there was one time when I'm bolting down this hallway, I can hear the footsteps of the guy chasing me. And it opens up into this tiny little living room. And there's five Cubans on one side. The fridge is on the other side. I don't have time to explain myself, so I just wave to them, and I let myself into their fridge.
Wow.
And they don't even blink. You know, the guy comes in, they're like, no, we didn't see anything. And then they let me out, give me a bowl of rice and beans. I made a lot of friends that way.
And ate a lot of rice and beans.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I want to know, are you terrified during these moments? I can't even imagine.
Absolutely not. You're too busy thinking.
Yeah.
Certainly to be afraid. You know, you're processing, I think, probably in the same way that when you're a pilot in a plane and the plane's going down,
yeah,
you're not wasting any time being scared. You're doing a ton of stuff.
Sure.
There are moments when you're afraid, but they're odd because they're when nothing's happening. I don't know if anybody saw Jurassic Park, and there was that very first one where they're in the Jeep and the glass of water is shaking every time the T-Rex takes a step.
Sure.
That's terrifying, but there's no T-Rex. You never see a dinosaur.
Right.
And so when things are happening, you're busy, and in a funny way, and I hope my parents don't ever hear this, those are the moments you live for. Mm-hmm. And I will give you yet another example, if you will bear with me. I went into Sudan to film a series, and it's practically impossible to get in there as an independent filmmaker. You simply can't get permission. So you go to the neighboring country called Chad, and you cross the entire country on a tiny little UN plane, and when you get to the border of Sudan, you find a rebel group to take you in. And I did all of that. I had a three-month valid visa in Chad, so I spent most of my time in Sudan. In the end, I come back into Chad on a donkey with a week left on my visa, thinking, no problem, I got this. You know, I'll just hop on the little UN plane, I'll cross the country to the western border, I'll get to the capital, and I'll go home. Well, the day I crossed back into Chad, a war broke out.
Oh, my.
Huge columns of Chadian rebels heading for the capital, which they then put under siege. And as they passed that little airport I was supposed to take the plane from, they bombed it. So the airport shut down, and I then had basically 6 days to get 650 miles across trackless desert to the capital before my visa ran out, and they were going to put me in jail. Oh. And you don't want to be in a Chadian jail. It's one of the 25 poorest countries in the world.
Oh.
And my only option at that point were they have these huge trucks, you know, tires that are taller than you are, and they carry tons of sorghum or millet across to the capital. And they fill up the truck with the sorghum and millet, and for $11, you can sit on top of it a little like a vulture. for 4.5 days, you're going 11 miles an hour. And for $11, they will take you. Now, the problem with this great idea wasn't the war. It wasn't the military, and it wasn't the rebels. It was bandits, because bandits hit every one of these trucks. And a white woman is a perfect hostage. I never would have made it through a bandit attack.
Yeah.
So I had at that point literally sort of 24 hours to figure out how am I going to do this. And the only analogy I can think of is, I don't know if you ever saw Apollo 13 with Tom Hanks.
Sure.
The astronauts are out there. They don't have enough oxygen to get back. And an engineer shows up at NASA with an armful of parts, and he throws them on the table, and he says, you're going to build an air scrubber. You've got 1 hour. If it's not on the table, you don't have it. Go. Basically, that's what I say. This is a magic moment. The stakes are relatively high, but there's this feeling of, okay, what have I got? I'm in a base camp.
Yeah.
You know, what raw materials can I use to make this happen? And so the first thing I did was to go buy an old, rusty 55-gallon drum. And midnight, when everyone was asleep, nobody was watching, I welded all of my camera equipment inside. So nobody could get at it. Nobody knew who it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the market, and I got a chicken, dead chicken, big dead rooster. And I put it out in the sun for the day, because I had $14,000 and 2 passports on me, and I needed a way to carry them so that nobody would know and nobody would want them.
Yes.
And so I put them in a Ziploc bag, and when the chicken started to go bad, I stuffed them inside the chicken.
Wow.
And then
I put that
in a Ziploc bag. Basically, here was something everybody would recognize, but nobody would covet. Nobody would try and take from me. And then the last thing, I had a full burqa, which is that head-to-toe covering. This is a Muslim country.
Yeah.
Where you can only see the eyes, the hands, and the feet.
Uh-huh.
So I put that on, and then I dyed my hands, my feet, and a raccoon stripe across my eyes, which took a month to wear off, with the very dark henna. So effectively, I looked African.
Yes.
And then I went to the market and found among the 57 passengers who was a patriarch who was traveling with 3 wives and children, and Islam allows you to take 4 wives, and so I negotiated with him that I would travel with his family as his 4th wife and pay him on the other end. And off we went. And this is the wonder of this. And it always, you know, I love my job because good stuff always happens, and it was a hard 3 months. A woman alone in North Africa, it can be tough. But this is how it ended. We were hit twice by bandits, and every time the women sort of move off to one side and the men negotiate. And this is a high-stress situation because the bandits regularly shoot people.
Oh.
And all they had to do, any one of 57 people, if they'd pointed to me and said, Nazaranya, white woman, mm-hmm. all the pressure would have been off of them.
Right.
And
right.
nobody outed me. Not once, but twice. They protected me. They knew I wasn't African or Arab. And yet they took great care of me. And then after about 3 days, the women started coming up to me and saying in Arabic, Nazaranya, the chicken, it's gone bad. You should throw it away. And I'd say, no, I think I can still cook it. And they'd walk away shaking their heads and saying in Arabic, stupid white woman. And I knew that they would think a white woman was too stupid to know when a chicken had gone off, which is why I chose it.
Oh my!
That is just so smart.
I'm in awe. My jaw is to the ground right now.
So just because I'm so fascinated with this kind of experience that you're talking about, because of the adrenaline kind of thing, just give our listeners, like, with that kind of adrenaline going on, what do you do to relax?
I love to surf. I mean, here or there.
Anywhere. Like, if you're in that kind of, you know, where your sympathetic nervous system is just on fire for so long, how do you calm down? How long does it take?
It's funny because you're not, again, when the danger's happening, when the bandits show up, the adrenaline is simply putting you in high gear. It's like life in living color.
Yeah.
Instead of the typical black and white. And that, to me, is actually a good feeling because it's, I hate to say this, it really is alive. In the same sense that I covered the Morsi Revolution, the last Egyptian revolution, And you're in Tahrir Square, which is where this revolution took place, and there's 500,000 people, and it's this huge party demonstration, and they're all ready to put themselves into harm's way to create change, and the air is crackling with energy, and you're watching something larger than yourself. This is history happening mm-hmm. all around you, and you're a part of it. It's like the Berlin Wall coming down. Mm. And you're not thinking, I'm scared, or where do I go to relax?
Right.
You're caught up in that. You're a part of it. So the question almost is a non sequitur, because relaxation isn't a part of that equation.
Right.
Got it. Okay.
There's certainly times, I think, that the times when it becomes an issue is the waiting periods, or in between when nothing's happening, or when you don't have a problem that you're working to solve.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Karin Muller. She's a war journalist, and we're just going to take a quick break to hear a word from Vantage.
Were you diagnosed with a mental health-related disorder and feel stigmatized so much you find yourself unable to reach out for help? At Vantage Point Recovery, we believe that every single human being has unlimited potential that is often unrealized. While a diagnosis offers a starting place to unpack what is blocking our clients from accessing that part of themselves, we do not believe they are their diagnosis. We believe that within every diagnosis lies a seed of hope and opportunity for our clients to realize more of who they really are so they can become who they want to be. Call us today at 888-668-5959 to see how our program may be a fit for you or a loved one.
Welcome back. We're talking with Karin Muller. Hey, Karin, I have a question for you. Why do you think that in your Sudan chicken story and all these other fascinating and incredibly interesting stories that you have been telling us, that people are so willing to help you?
Oh, I love that question. Thank you so much. It's sort of the motto of my life.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are fundamentally good.
Yeah.
You know, 1 in 10,000 may be a sociopath having a bad day, but I frankly haven't met that person yet, and I have had thousands of good experiences on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And what saddens me so much in some ways is that America is so big and so monolithic, and we don't have any. I'm from Europe where there are borders everywhere, but we don't have that. And so I think Americans, they're afraid. They're afraid to go and put themselves out there. They're afraid of rejection. Mm-hmm. What if that person doesn't like me? What if they won't help me? And so they never find out that that never happens.
Right.
Mm-hmm. People will almost always help. I thoroughly and absolutely believe in the kindness of strangers. And I have 20 years of experience in the field to back it up.
Oh, that's so beautiful. I love that.
So I have some questions for you.
Yeah.
I'm on here because I'm actually talking to the real experts, because I have no degree in psychology or sociology or anything else like that. Tell me what you think. What does this tell you about people?
Oh,
sorry.
Yeah, I know. We're both looking at each other. You go first.
Oh, I was going to say, well, I do think that human beings by nature are compassionate and caring, and we're built in with a need for empathy and kindness and love. And I think that when we do demonstrate that, there's such a good, warm feeling that comes throughout us that, you know, if you offer people the opportunity, if you believe in the good of people, I think you see more of the good in people.
Yeah.
And how do we convince people here in the United States that it's okay to go out there and take a risk? It's okay to travel by yourself or to take a train or even to hitchhike when they're scared. What do you say?
So, yeah, there's a lot I want to say. Well, first, I want to go back to your question initially, and I think it's sort of interesting when you were talking, it's interesting how you asked the grandma for help just individually. It wasn't like you were asking a crowd of people for help. And so I think there's something about when you ask a person individually, it's like that kitty, genesis, whatever that's
diffusion of responsibility.
Exactly.
People
so
knew
it was
somebody was in trouble and
exactly.
Everybody thought someone else was helping.
So it was really nice that you sort of, you know, said, grandma, help me, like, you know, and maybe she was the only one around. But I think that, yeah, I think when you're asked individually, it's like, oh my gosh, how can I help this person? And I think when you ask a group of people, everyone's kind of shell-shocked or they expect somebody else to do it. So that, to me, is sort of what stands out, is just kind of asking somebody individually rather than in a group. It's almost like sending a group email asking for something versus sending somebody a personal email. Like, it's just that personal touch, I think, that helps.
I think that's a good point.
Very true.
Yeah,
absolutely true.
So I'm sorry. So what was the second? Oh, the second question is how can we
get people to take more risks? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that I'm sort of a moderate in that way, because I was a huge risk taker when I was younger. Certainly not to your degree, Karen, but definitely a risk taker. And sometimes I think, as you started your story, so this is a stupid thing that I did. I think that sometimes we can do kind of not so smart things with risks. But I think some moderate amount of risk, when, you know, it's like I tell people, well, if you never ask, how will you ever know whether you could have gotten what you wanted?
Right.
You know, so take that risk. And just trying to help people move through their desire to please people or fear of rejection, and to help them just become centered that, you know, whose opinion really counts. It's mm-hmm. really your own
yeah.
in the end. And if you're a reasonably good person, you're going to do the right thing most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a question of just safety. And I think the news really sensationalizes, you know, this dangerous situation. And it kind of like everybody feeds off of that. And so I think that's why a lot of people aren't taking risks or going to different countries, because I think that they're sort of, you know, trained at a young age that it's dangerous and you shouldn't do it. And, you know, and then, of course, if you have like a Jewish mom like me, forget it. You know, you can't go anywhere. But I mean, I think it's like that's so nice that you're kind of giving us, you know, that other side. And that, you know, that it isn't true, and it is safe, and it's okay, and you have to take risks to sort of to see how good people are. So I really love that message.
Yep. You have to be able to prove it, not just disprove it. Let me give you take that great comment you just made one step further. I went with National Geographic for seven months down the spine of the Andes, and we were following the ancient Inca Highway. And when I first said I was going to do this, everybody came back to me and said, oh, there was a girl that disappeared on the, you know, the Inca Road, and it's so dangerous. Mm. Well, if you do the numbers, 40,000 people do that tiny little bit of trail, and the girl disappeared 4 years earlier, so it's probably less dangerous than getting in your car and doing a drive. But here's the real interesting fact. The only thing the media ever talks about is unusual stuff.
Yes.
You don't hear about every car accident in the United States where somebody dies, because it's so common. The reason that was news is because it's so uncommon for somebody to disappear off the Inca Trail.
Yes.
That it stayed in the news for months. So frankly, if something is in the news, something bad, oh, they're harassing women in India, that means it's so uncommon. That is making the news.
Interesting.
I love that flip side.
Yeah.
I absolutely love that. And I feel like that can help with our clients who deal with anxiety. I think that people get very stuck on something, but you're basically giving them the you know, the opposite. I love that. It's really, really good. Good piece of it.
And there is some research that suggests that if you give people actually real numbers about things, that that can actually help to moderate anxiety to some degree. Because sometimes people do have completely bogus ideas in their minds about how dangerous one thing is, and they're not paying attention to
yes.
some of the things that are really dangerous.
Exactly. Yeah. No, that's what happened with my older son. He saw some video on YouTube about the deadliest beaches in America. He came across it by accident. And he was having nightmares about sharks and getting really scared. And so I pulled up statistics on he's like a numbers guy, so I knew this would help him. And I pulled up statistics on sharks and how it was not common at all for a shark to attack, you know, in reality. And it kind of helped him see, like, okay, yeah, I see it's not so dangerous and things like that. Yeah.
Yep. Now here's another statistic. You know, how many people have died by Muslim attacks in the United States in the last year? A year ago, it was 2 people. How many people in that same year died falling in a bathtub? Over 700.
Wow.
Interesting.
So, you know, do we outlaw bathtubs?
Exactly. Exactly. Yes.
I mean, the reality, the news, the media publishes, I don't blame them completely, because they publish what people want to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
So if we changed the channel, they would stop talking about this stuff. But I think it is a vicious cycle. And I think if you keep in mind that if it's in the news, it's because it's exceedingly uncommon.
Yeah.
It's newsworthy.
Right, exactly.
That helps put it in perspective.
Yes. Unbelievable. Wow.
That's great. You know, I never thought about it that way. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Karen, do you ever feel pressure from, you know, your peers to be more sensationalized in your reporting of things?
Yes, certainly anybody who does products for broadcast, that's the bread and butter. If you look at reality TV, they're looking for conflict.
Yeah.
And the way I get around that is I go do my research, I film for 3 months or more, I come back and I edit these films myself.
Mm.
And and I take a financial hit for that, and I take a huge time hit. I essentially spend 6 to 9 months in a tiny little room while my eyes migrate to the top of my head like a frog so I can see 4 monitors and my feet get flatter and flatter. But I do that because I need to tell my own story, which is not sensationalized. I need to tell the story of the people who trusted me to tell their story. Mm-hmm. And I need to protect them in case they said something that might get them in trouble with their government. But it goes back to that same, the entire goal of my life is to humanize. Mm. And you're not going to humanize somebody if you make them look like a terrorist. You're going to humanize them if you make them look like an owl fisherman.
Yes.
Who's living their life just like we're trying to live our lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh,
so absolutely, and the way to resist that is simply to say no. And the interesting thing was the first time I did a film on my own, all the documentary broadcasters said, you're going to fail. Mm. Nobody's going to watch something like that.
Yeah.
And in fact, the films are extremely popular. I think the media tends to underestimate the sophistication of the viewing audience.
I so agree with that. It's
yes.
been such a frustrating thing because for a while I was writing some treatments for some reality shows and getting them in front of people because I wanted to write feel-good, good ending types of things, you know? And everybody said, nobody's going to watch that. There's not enough pain. There's not enough suffering. And I'm saying, why don't we give it a try? Why don't we see? Because and then I would point the finger at some of the ones that were successful. Well, that's only because so-and-so did it or so-and-so did it. I think we so underestimate the value of people wanting to actually become closer, more intimate, more humane, and experience, you know, the depth of life instead of all the pain and suffering and drama.
Exactly. Yeah. I 100% agree. Yeah. Unbelievable.
It goes back to what you said. People feel good when they do a good deed or when they compassion, empathy, understanding. These are all things that physically and emotionally make you feel better. Why wouldn't watching something like that also have that effect?
Sure. Yeah.
Well, on that same topic, I can imagine some amazing things have kind of come of your travels. So I would love to know a little bit about that. Maybe, you know, your favorite things.
Yeah, but let me take a right turn here and give you an example that you may not have been expecting. Because the other thing that I love about my travels is that they teach me things I'm not expecting. They often hold up a mirror to me and make me have to reassess all of my preconceived emotions and stereotypes, which I think I've gotten rid of, and yet you never really do. I'm back in Chad here, I was living in a refugee camp, and I was doing, in between filming things, I was talking to the people and interviewing them, and I had just interviewed an older woman, and she had 3 friends with her. So she was probably in her 60s and 70s, of being very old for North Africa. And after asking 45 minutes of questions, I typically turn it around and say, is there anything you want to ask me? That's only fair, right? I've just been digging around in their lives.
Yeah.
I'm starting to take my cameras apart. And I know exactly what's coming. I call it the catechism. The very first question, how old are you? At the time, I was 48. Are you married? No. Do you have children? No. And I look up, and all 4 people are crying. There's this old man sitting there, and he has tears streaming down his face.
Oh.
And one of the women says, well, there's this old guy on the other side of camp. He's got 3 wives, but he can take one more. And someone else says, well, you're not fertile anymore, but he might still have you.
Oh, my gosh. Oh,
you know, wow. Up until that, and this is a magic moment for me. This is not in any way a negative, because up until that, it's sort of, you know, I was feeling pretty good about myself.
Yes.
I traveled halfway around the world. You know, I gotten into this really remote place. I had all this camera equipment.
Sure.
And yet this was that moment when you can see how they see you.
Wow.
And through their eyes, what their priorities are, what means a lot to them.
Sure. Yeah.
This is ultimately what you're going for, because if we don't understand each other, once again, we will never have peace.
Oh.
And in their eyes, what really mattered was, you know, did I have a husband? Did I have children? Did I have sons? That is their world and their priority system. They couldn't care less that I had a honking big camera on me.
Right, exactly. You know? Sure. It sounds like a Jewish mother to me. I'll be honest with you. That's their priority, too. Same thing. It's really funny, but
Hey, and I told you about my family, too. I'm getting my PhD, and my parents are saying, but where's the boyfriend?
Right.
Where's the boyfriend?
Yes.
That one, he's not going to marry you. Where's the boyfriend? Like, hello?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that is.
There you go. We are all the same.
Right.
That's the ultimate answer to every trip. Yeah. I come back saying, wow, we're all the same. If only we could figure that out, every other problem in this world would go away.
Now, I have a question, because obviously you've been to so many different countries, so you can't speak that many languages. How do you communicate, or is it mostly facial gestures, or, you know, how are you talking to the locals?
Well, first of all, I haven't been to that many countries because I tend to go for 3 to 12 months.
Okay.
So, you know, and yes, I learn the language.
Oh,
I never go to a country if I don't speak the language fluently. I won't speak it with grammatical perfection, far from it, but I go with a vocabulary of 3,000 words, which is a typical sitcom vocabulary.
This is incredible.
And the way I do that is a year before my departure date, I start to study 1 to 2 hours a day. And I do not take a day off because I know, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. I know what happens if I don't have the language. The language is really my fallback if I get into trouble or I need anything.
Yeah.
And so I try and maintain as many as I can. And some languages like Spanish are relatively useful. You can use them in more than one country. The harder ones like Chinese, you really, really have to work at.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, my God. So
how many languages?
Exactly. Now we have to know.
I try and maintain 6. It's a little hard to do if you can't read them. I can't read Chinese, for example. Can't read Japanese. Arabic script is a little bit tough as well. But ultimately, if you want to get the truth, you cannot only speak to that narrow strata of society that speaks English. That's a slanted sample space.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to speak to, in the refugee camps, the women and the children and the people on the boat and the pilot. And by the way, if you can speak the language or even butcher the language, you will have friends everywhere.
That's so nice. Yeah.
You know, it's true. I remember being on a plane when I was a kid and I was sitting next to a Chinese lady and I wanted to learn how to count in Chinese because I thought it would be neat to just have something. And I'm probably going to do this wrong. It was so many years ago, but I remember Yat Yi Som Say Ung Luk Chut Bot. Am I close?
Nice. Fabulous. Actually, you know what? You end up with the other issue, which is if you speak the language, especially if it's not a major language. When I was in Vietnam, I was one of the only foreigner they'd seen for 30 years, and then certainly the only one that spoke Vietnamese. And I remember being in the back of a bus, and it was a long ride. It was about 17 hours. And I spoke to the driver, so somebody overheard me, and the word went around that I could speak Vietnamese. And this is why I love traveling alone as a woman. It makes you very approachable.
Mm-hmm.
The downside of that is they will talk to you for 17 solid hours. And that is totally exhausting. So here's the trick. You look for a boy. He's going to be somewhere around 14 years old. Because everybody, literally, they pile on you and they're tugging at your shoulder and they're all shouting questions at you because they're so desperate to find out who you are and what you're doing here and all of that. So you grab the kid and you say to him, I will only speak to you.
Uh-huh.
And then you throw him back in the pile. And they beat the tar out of him until somebody wins and he comes back to you with a question. You answer the question, you toss him back in the pile.
Uh-huh.
And you could do this for hours. And, you know, he's having a good time because he's the center of attention. They're getting their questions answered, and you're getting a little bit of a break.
That is so smart.
That's incredible.
He's like the mediator. Oh, I love that. That's so cool.
That is so funny. And, you know, back to the languages, too. It's so true that if you just even try when you go to a different country and you just even have 5 words and know how to say hello or thank you or whatever, and you're trying, people are so much more responsive.
And appreciative.
They're appreciative, hugely appreciative. And here's something else you can do. And, you know, after the years, decades of traveling like this, you have this huge bag of tricks that you carry around with you. Let's say you want to go and live in a Maasai village, the East African warrior tribe. And this actually did happen to me. So you're in a hut, and there's 13, 14 people around, and I was living with the first wife of the chief, or was planning on it. And they're all talking in rapid-fire Maasai. I spoke about 200 words of Maasai, not more, and I couldn't understand anything anybody was saying. And you're looking, once again, for something. This is make or break for the entire 6 months. I'm looking for a girl. She's going to be between 8 and 14 years old, 14 being the marrying age. So she's single, but she's old enough, and she's probably taking care of a lot of siblings. And she generally finds me because she sees that I'm completely, you know, baffled. And she'll come up to him. The wife will come up and say, hey, you want to eat something? You hungry? And I won't get a word. And she'll come up and she'll say, you eat now.
Mm-hmm.
I call it a telegram Maasai. And I understand her. And that's my girl. And she's going to be my shadow and sidekick for the entire time I'm there. And she's going to translate, she's going to give me words, she's going to tell me what to do. And the next thing you do is, I travel light, but I bring one large piece of paper. I'm talking about something that's probably 2 by 3 feet.
Okay.
And what you're going to do is you're going to develop a genealogy. And so I write down the name of my chief and his 4 wives and maybe a spear and a cooking pot to separate men and women, and I start to draw in all of the names of the kids. And this girl will figure it out very quickly, and she will help me to fill it in. And that's because these are social societies. So their relationships are enormously important.
Yes.
And I carry this thing around with me everywhere. And then one day, some woman will show up at the door, and the girl will immediately whip out my genealogy and will point and say, "That's her."
Oh.
And I'll know a lot about her. I know she has 3 sons, and I'll be able to say, "Oh, you have a son called Ndutu,"
right.
And she will smile until her face cracks because no other foreigner has ever understood the village social structure or cared.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And then I can put in a little note there, torn left earlobe, so that I know who she is and
sure.
will recognize her
sure.
again. So when you understand that, you know, we are economic societies, we work on money, they work on relationships. And if you're going to be there and you can figure out their relationships, that will open any door that you could possibly want.
That is beautiful.
Just takes a girl and a piece of paper.
Girl and a piece of paper. I love these little snippet takeaways. Hold on. Here's a word from our sponsor.
Do you swear off drugs or alcohol in the morning, only to succumb to the thought later in the day? According to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration's 2012 survey on drug use and health, it was shown that roughly 8.4 million adults in the U.S. suffered from addiction and mental health-related disorders. Vantage Point Recovery, specializing in intensive treatment for those struggling with addiction and mental health-related disorders, has a place for you. Located in Thousand Oaks, California, call us today at 888-668-5959 to see how our program may be a fit for you or a loved one.
Okay, my goodness. So many things. So what have we not asked you that you are just chomping at the bit to tell us about?
Oh, wow. Gee.
What do you think on that? Again, we're talking with Karin Muller, who is a war journalist, for those of you who just tuned in.
Yeah, okay, let me, I love the positive, and again, 99% of what happened to me is always positive, but just in case you're out there and you do get into trouble, there's something that I do that generally helps get me out of trouble, especially if I don't have any locals around to save me.
Mm-hmm.
And I figure this out, usually as always the hard way, in the field. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
I was 20, I was young, I was stupid, and I was in a on an island called Palawan. It's very remote, it's called the Wild Island, and that was, at that time, there was an active communist insurgency called the NPA, the New People's Army, and at one point they decided that they needed control of my village. And the way they do that is they come in and over a period of months they recruit people's sons and fathers and brothers, and when they feel strong enough, they show themselves. One day my neighbor came to me, my best friend and neighbor, and she said, "Karin, tomorrow the NPA are coming for you." And the NPA, it was just a given to them that any Peace Corps volunteer was in fact a CIA agent. Why else would you be in some remote area?
Sure.
You know, apparently doing nothing. So this was early in the morning, and it was again a little bit like the Apollo 13. You're sitting there and saying, "What do I do now?" Now, I had the choice of running for town. If I had left, they would have let me go. I could never have come back because that would have been a tacit agreement with them that I must be doing something wrong, like CIA. Or I could stay, and another volunteer had been kidnapped, so there was a certain amount of risk involved. Now, it turns out in my village, in every village in the Philippines, we have these little sari-sari stores. They're stores the size of a dining room table, and they just sell essentials, like mung beans and salt and rice and, crucially, sugar and coffee, those being two huge luxuries in the village. So I went around, and I cleaned out my entire village supply of sugar and coffee, and then I got every cracked mug and cup I could borrow from my neighbors and friends. And I put them all in my tiny little kitchen. I had a hut I built myself up on stilts, and I waited. I sat and I waited and I waited through the afternoon and into the evening.
Oh my God.
8 p.m. I was sure they weren't coming when I heard a sound that was very distinctive. The sound of a machine gun bumping up against an ammo belt.
Oh.
And I look out and in the moonlight I can see 17 gorillas, communist gorillas, sort of jogging through my melon patch. And they come up the stairs. And the leader kicks in my double doors to make an entrance. You have to understand my entire hut's the size of a very small living room.
Mm.
And I'm standing right there behind the doors. And I say what I've been thinking the entire day, and I say it with total feeling. Thank God you're here. I have been waiting for you all day. Please make yourself some coffee, leave your guns at the door. And the thing is, it was so unexpected.
Oh,
and this is really it. You're changing the paradigm. But and when people are hit with something that out of their experience, they tend to freeze.
Yeah.
And then they generally go along with it because they don't really know what else to do and they're not processing fast enough. So he looks and he sees I mean it because there's coffee and mugs and sugar and everything else. So he takes off his gun, he drops it at the door. There's this lovely pile of 17 guns at the door and he makes himself some coffee. And there's room for one tiny little table in my hut and two chairs. And I make sure I'm sitting in one chair and he's sitting in the other and everybody sort of scrunches on the floor around us. And it turns out you cannot interrogate somebody you're having coffee with.
Oh.
And so we have a delightful conversation. I'm digging wells at the time. I need help because the foundations are really heavy. And you know, he says, well, let us know. So, in fact, I do. I put out the word. Tuesday, we're dropping Rodrigo's well. You know, 15 guys show up. I don't ask any questions. They help me with the well. The rest of my stay there, I had a great relationship with the NPA, with the New People's Army and the insurgents.
I don't even know what to
say. Go
ahead. Wow. So did you end up explaining, did they ever ask why you're there, any of that?
That was part of the conversation.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it was more the tenor and the tone. It wasn't an interrogation in the sense that, you know, what are you doing here and what are we going to do to you? It was about, you know, here I'm digging these wells and gossip and we call it chismis and, you know, what's going wrong and the chickens and so-and-so's goat got out, that kind of thing. It was just a completely different style of conversation. And what the seed of the idea there is two things. First of all, thank God you're here.
Right.
Again, two black belts, I used to teach self-defense. I don't do that anymore because I think, I know as a judo competitor, women are not strong enough to fight men.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, most women I know are smarter, certainly smarter than a guy who's going to mug you. And so stay out of that physical arena, use your head. And
yeah.
If you can do something that's going to rock them back, if you can memorize that one sentence, thank God you're here, I guarantee you that's going to rock them back. It's going to give you about 30 seconds of control. What you do after that is up to you, but, you know, again, I have faith. People are bright.
Yeah.
They're going to figure out what happens after that.
Oh, my God. You have
so
been
just, you know, just shift it all around. I've used it, you know, on the wrong side of 14th Street in Washington, D.C. at 1 in the morning where you meet a pack of guys and everybody will say, you should run, you know. I walk right up to them. I say, thank God you're here. I'm so lost. I'm trying to get to X metro station.
Oh, my God.
And every single time I get the same response, I hope to God my mother's not hearing this. But, you know, they'll be frozen for a minute. Somebody will start to give direction. The leader will take over. Every time they walk me to the station, they usually surround me to keep me safe. And the whole time they're giving me a lecture. Lady, don't you know it's dangerous out here? You
right, hurts.
Drop me off at the station. Maybe they go mug someone else. I don't know. It works.
Well, that is a great thing to leave our listeners with.
You have been absolutely beyond phenomenal. I knew it the first time I met you that you were just going to be incredible and just have just beautiful, beautiful insight for our listeners. We cannot thank you enough. Do you have any final kind of last, like maybe a one sentence?
Word, one sentence.
Thank you so much for everything. Trust in the kindness of strangers.
I love it.
Thank you so much, Karen Muller, war journalist. Thank you so much.
Yes, and we need to thank our sponsor, Vantage Recovery Point. And next week we have Go Zen Anxiety Site for Kids with Rini Jane. Very excited.
It's
so
very, very cool. It's an anxiety site for kids, just how to help kids have less anxiety. I absolutely love it. It's great. So visit us on Twitter at DocTherapist1 or visit our website, docandtherapist.com, and you can send emails to docandtherapist@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening. We love y'all.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.